Many of your research topics as an undergrad and as a graduate student focused on the quest, in your terms, although I'm taking it out of context here, the quest for an interracial DMZ, whether it's the Southern Tenant Farmers Union or the Communist Party in the Great Depression, which became your first book.
Right.
It seems very much more so than most scholars that I've spoken to, mm-hmm. that your life and your work are so tightly bound up, incredibly tightly bound up. I thought maybe if you could take us through some of your research, and what you were looking for, what you found, and maybe make some comments about how it related to your life. That would be very useful.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things is, let me talk about my life. In the late 60s. I've already mentioned that I spent a lot of time with my girlfriend's extended family, but the apartment we lived in was this interracial DMZ. There were the two of us. There was another couple, a white couple, Bruce and Wendy. There were my girlfriend's younger siblings. There were high school students we worked with in the Columbia. It was an interracial communal apartment. And then periodically, radicals from all over the world would come stay. And this was at a time, when Black Power was kind of dividing the movement. And we had this space where people from different, racial and class, cultural and national backgrounds came together in solidarity and love and friendship. And I understood that in my time in the late 60s, this was very unique. So what I guess I was looking for in history is other moments where people tried to bring, people across the color line, and what were the conditions under which people could be brought together, but also under what conditions were African Americans feeling suppressed to achieve this interracial solidarity? Because that was one of the things that I encountered in the Southern Tenant Farmers Union when, this was brought together. There was this moment when the ex-Klan members and the ex-Garvey people came together, to fight the planters and fight the evictions under the Agricultural Adjustment Act. But in the later 30s, I came across these absolutely devastating letters by a Black minister named E.B. McKinney, who had been the original person who drew many of the Black workers in, bitterly attacking the socialists for not really being deeply committed to racial equality, for still having segregated bathrooms at the union headquarters, for not really respecting Black leadership. And I realized, I realized that interracial solidarity could not be done at the expense of African Americans achieving leadership, defining their own growth and history and agenda. And so that was the real challenge. I mean, I was very aware of, so I'd see that also with the Communist Party when I studied it, that there were tensions, always tensions around creating this interracial space. Tensions from the white side in terms of the inherited prejudices, but also tensions from the Black side feeling that sometimes Black leadership could be smothered in interracial organizations. And so I didn't, I understood how difficult this was, and I didn't want to sacrifice accuracy and integrity to create a romantic story of love and harmony. I wanted an honest portrait of what the issues were as well as the possibilities.
You write on page 94 of White Boy, somehow I would have to find a way of reconciling nationalism and interracialism, of defending the legitimacy of interracial love and friendship while still supporting organizations and movements that use nationalist strategies to advance the black community's interests. And that's really what you were looking for in that.
Yeah. And some people would say it was an impossible task or an impossible dream, but I felt it was potentially a dynamic or creative tension. And I was going to face the abyss. That's how I saw it. I was going to go, if this was the abyss that most white radicals shrank from, I was going to face it head on and try to walk through it.
Now, you seem to respect the communists and the Communist Party's work in the 1930s in Harlem. And look for that as a model of somehow. Is that accurate?
Well, I think that one of the things about the Communist Party that impressed me is they understood and respected black nationalism. They understood that nationalists were often the most passionate fighters for black freedom, and that they had to win nationalists over, not suppress them. And they were trying to figure out a way to incorporate the nationalist impulse into an interracial movement. You know, a lot of their best militants had come out of the Garvey movement. Now, you know, there were a lot of problems with the communist political culture, to put it mildly, you know, in terms of how decisions were made. But as a theoretical construct, there were two things that I respected about them. One is they absolutely believed that whites had to come to terms with, understand, and fight their own racism. And my favorite quote about from the Communist Party, which I still think is applicable, and I actually used it when we were having that campaign to move the Organization of American Historians convention from the Adams Mark a few years ago. It is the duty of the white communist to leap at the throat of the 100% chauvinist who strikes a Negro in the face. I believe that that is a principle which still holds, that if you're ever going to achieve interracial solidarity in this country, then white people who support this have to fight racism wherever they find it, even when it's extremely inconvenient, and show black people that they are willing to put themselves on the line when it turns up. And that's the only way to overcome the suspicions that African Americans have of interracial solidarity. The Communist Party understood that it was right for black people to be suspicious of whites. Why shouldn't they be, given the past history, and that whites had to prove themselves as anti-racist fighters before there could be any interracial solidarity? And so I thought there were a lot of things there that really rang true to me. That, you know, again, with all due understanding of what Stalinism represented as a murderously hierarchical social formation, Stalinism was a corruption of a movement that had many progressive features, and it didn't mean that at various times you couldn't have a communist movement that didn't advance, you know, human freedom and solidarity and social justice. So, you know.
Now, you were, besides your intellectual engagement with the Communist Party, you were actively involved as a in the work of SDS and the Weather Underground for a short period of time.
Well, I want to correct it. I never was involved with the Weather Underground.
Oh, the Weathermen.
When the Weathermen moved in the direction of underground tactics and of the propaganda of the deed and acts of political violence, that's when I left before that. I thought I was with Weathermen when they were thinking about very militant public mass action aimed at radicalizing working class youth. So, You know, I want to make that distinction because it's a very important one, especially now. I don't support bombing and never did bombings and acts of violence directed at property or persons. Mm-hmm. I supported, you know, very militant public mass protests.
Yeah, that's clear from the book White Boy, and yeah. I think readers will recognize that. I'm wondering how well these organizations, during the time you were involved in them, how well they fared on the issue of achieving sort of an interracial DMZ.
I think they didn't even try most of the time. I mean, they accepted the idea that there would be a black movement and a white movement, and there would be negotiations to achieve common objectives. The conception of an interracial DMZ didn't exist within, you know, the New Left. I mean, that was one of the things that I had trouble with. I felt I had a conception of the politics of race and radicalism that wasn't echoed anywhere else except in traditional communist organizations like Progressive Labor, which talked about an interracial movement but also regarded black nationalism as reactionary. I was trying to do something which in its time, you know, was possibly, you know, was very heterodox. I wanted to respect black nationalism and have a zone of interracial solidarity and sociability. And that was something that, you know, very few organizations that I ran into, you know, accepted, promoted, or even conceptualized. And in that sense, I felt very alone and very isolated. I didn't know anybody else who really thought the way I did at that time. I guess maybe that's why I ended up writing this book. Yeah. It took 30 years before I had the courage to put it forward. You know, I think that's, you know, in fact, in thinking about it, it wasn't until the 90s that I was ready to put these ideas out directly rather than indirectly through my historical writing.
One of the other things that you've been very heavily involved in is the creation and the building of black studies, mm-hmm. as a legitimate discipline, yeah. in academe. I was thinking this would be a good opportunity to. Most people don't really know much. I mean, they reading here and there. If you could take us into that world as a white man, mm-hmm. in a black studies department at Fordham, and just take us through that story.
Okay, sure. I got involved in black studies very accidentally. When my fellowship ran, two things had happened at Columbia that, you know, required me to look for a job. One is, as a result of a demonstration in the Columbia campus, I was put on permanent censure by the Columbia administration, which meant that I would be automatically expelled from the doctoral program if I ever violated university rules again. So that was one thing. The other was my fellowship ran out, and so in the spring of 1970, I started looking for teaching jobs, and all of the letters I sent out went to American history programs or history departments in the various colleges and community colleges of the New York metropolitan area. I assumed that if I was going to get a job, I would have to be in history or American history. And I think I might have also sent a couple of resumes to like tutoring programs, you know, that were being set up in the city university. Didn't send a single letter to a black studies department because I had assumed that, you know, black studies departments would pretty much only at this point want black faculty. The whole concept of black studies was relatively recent. The first program was created in 1967 at San Francisco State. This was only 2 years later. Okay, so I'm getting these interviews with community colleges where I'm being asked, well, if we hire you, you teach Western Civ and American history. And then I'm playing basketball in Riverside Park with a white Irish kid I'd befriended, who was going to Fordham, who said his black history teacher asked the class if they knew anybody who could teach African American history. So he thought I'd be a good person to apply for the job because I had taught African American history in the summer program at Columbia that was run by Upward Bound. So I had done that for two summers. So I sent a letter to this, the Fordham Institute of Afro-American Studies, which began, first of all, I am white. And if you conceive of your program as something that is by and for black scholars and black students alone, I can respect that. But if you think that a white scholar with a background in this field could be, you know, someone who could potentially make a contribution, here are my credentials. And to my utter shock, I got a letter back saying, while we are primarily interested in giving black scholars an opportunity to do this work, our courses are open to the entire university. We think black studies is something everyone should, you know, benefit from. We like your background. Why don't you come in for an interview? So I come in, and the first question the person who interviewed me asked is, what do you want to teach? Not you will teach Western Civ. And on the spot, I made up three courses, the history of American racism, the history of black protest, and a course called Afro-Americans and the American Labor Movement. He said, very interesting, we'll get back to you. In 2 weeks, I'm offered this job. I mean, and so I had a choice. I could teach Western Civ and American history in a community college with departments run by middle-aged white men who I had nothing in common with, or I could go teach my dream courses in a black studies department. Now, I knew and anticipated that this would not be an easy situation given, you know, the emotions and the time and the feelings of that, you know, whites might be trying to control something that blacks needed to do for themselves. On the other hand, I wasn't looking forward to hanging out with middle-aged white men either, given my life, you know. So to me, it was, okay, I'm going to go with what I, you know, is connected to my life and work and let the chips fall where they may. And I entered this department where there were two other full-time people, five other part-time people, all of whom were black, but where the students represented a pretty interesting cross-section of the Fordham student population. There were a lot of white kids and Latino kids taking the courses. And it seemed like this particular black studies organization saw its mission as educating the entire university. And It also had a special mission for black students and the black community. You know, all the black student organizations were housed there. They had community outreach. And it was complicated because there were definitely some things that I felt it wasn't that easy for me to participate in. But in terms of the mission of reaching the larger community, I also saw that I could be an asset to this department because I could bring in a lot of, you know, my being there also made it easier for some white students to take the courses and help build enrollments. And it turned out that, you know, I made friends with the people in this in the institute, and I found a very exciting work environment that was at times racially tense. I mean, there were, you know, in the first couple of years, there were some black students who thought I shouldn't be teaching, who decided to manifest their opposition through sort of the theater of intimidation. They would sort of just come in the office and glower at me. But I also felt, you know, I felt my colleagues supported me. And anyway, this was my life. And so I just glowered back at them. You know, at times I panicked a little. At one point I had a bodyguard. Another point, for 2 weeks I carried a butcher knife in my attaché case, you know. And then I realized that, you know, there was no danger. This was theater. And once they saw that I was going to, you know, stick with it, you know, I was going to be left alone. And after a couple of years, it wasn't an overtly tense situation to be in. At least for the first maybe 5 years, I always felt, you know, a little uneasy because I really didn't know of anybody else who was in my position. I didn't know of any other white scholars. I knew a lot of white scholars who were teaching African American history. I didn't know of anybody else who was in the Black Studies department. And I, you know, but what happened is, you know, I was also used to being alone in my thoughts about race even before then. And the friendships I was developing with my colleagues were so powerful that it overcame the uneasiness. And then the moment of truth was when the administration tried to dissolve our department. And then we had to wage this very complicated battle to prevent our department from being dismantled by, on the one hand, finishing our dissertations, and the other hand, mobilizing our students, and the other hand, insisting, well, that would make three hands, I mean, so I don't know if the hand metaphor works, of having an outside committee evaluate us. So we did all of those things. Four of us finished our dissertations, but, you know, we had a student movement, that was multiracial to support us, and the outside committee ended up recommending not only that we not be dissolved, but that we be made into a formal department. And fighting that battle, you know, ended any sense of anxiety about being in there. You know, this was who I, you know, after we fought this battle, this was what I did. This is who I was. And if there was nobody else like me that I knew, you know, I could live with that. I had camaraderie, a sense of purpose. I was teaching, you know, the courses I want to. I had good relations with my students, and I was doing research that I was excited about. And if it meant that I was a little weird, hey, it wouldn't be the first time.
You now head the Urban Studies Department at Fordham. What's the racial atmosphere like today?
Fordham is becoming a much more racially diverse campus than it was in the 80s and early 90s. For a long time, the Black student population remained actually below the levels of the early 70s. We had very few Asian students and a growing but still small group of Latino students. I would say that in the 90s, we are now a campus where probably 25% of the undergraduates are students of color, and with the largest group Latino, but finally a sizable Asian group, a sizable Afro-American and Afro-Caribbean group, and also more and more mixed-race students, who are another factor in terms of cross-cultural collaboration. So, I mean, it's not that there aren't racial issues on the campus, but people deal with them fairly quickly. There's a lot of curiosity and intercultural activity that is going on. Like, if the Black students have an event, they want to make sure that students who are not Black attend it. You know, this is something that is encouraged. And my urban studies program, I'm very excited to say, does a lot of intercultural work. Every year now, we organize an underground hip-hop festival. And hip-hop is one of these cross, has become, especially underground, non-commercial hip-hop, has become this really political cross-cultural phenomenon. I mean, when we had, I don't know, DJ battles with to lead up, these are where disc jockeys compete against each other. There's, you know, for not disc jockeys in the R&B sense, but DJs in the hip-hop sense, where you're creating, you know, rhythmic sounds from records and other, you know, electronic mechanisms you use. The biggest group contributing the DJs were Philippine students. And the Philippine students at Fordham were totally into hip-hop. You know, that's something you wouldn't have realized, you know, because you think of it as African-American, Latino, white. You have a whole Philippine hip-hop scene. You have a South Asian hip-hop scene. And there, so this phenomenon has become something which really brings together different cultural groups. And, you know, that's been very exciting to me to be part of that. And I think it's for me, it's a great time to teach, because the intercultural connections are more dynamic and more complicated than at any time that I've been involved as a college teacher.
It's interesting that you bring up hip-hop as an arena of interracial mixing, because one of the things I did forget to ask you was about the role of sports in your life as another arena, and that's a major theme in your book, White Boy. Maybe you can say something about that.
Wow. I mean, you know, I grew up as a, you know, as a basketball player, as a tennis player, and in Brooklyn, both of these, the sports cultures that I were interracial. Basketball, you know, is something that would be obvious, but I was in an interracial tennis culture in Brooklyn in the late 50s and early 60s in this little public park called Lincoln Terrace Park in the border of Crown Heights and Brownsville. And this was a haven where civil servants played tennis. And there was a sizable group of African-American civil servants who joined together largely with Jewish civil servants. And this is where I learned to play tennis. There was a great coach there. And so I grew up playing sports, you know, in an interracial setting. And it continued when I went to college. I was an avid schoolyard basketball player. In addition to being a varsity tennis player, I used to play in the West Side and even in the late 60s in Harlem. And then when I had kids, I became involved in coaching. And I for 15 years, I coached baseball and basketball and ran youth leagues in Brooklyn, which, you know, crossed all kinds of cultural and racial lines. And ironically, that's where I became exposed to hip-hop, when I was driving around the basketball and baseball teams that I was coaching. So sports and music were my first entrees into cross-cultural, you know, activity, and they still remain central to it. Even though, you know, I embraced history, I never stopped being passionately involved with sports and music.
And you've also gone into struggles for gender equality as a result of some of the struggles over your daughters.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, one of the things in White Boy is how I was singled out by a women's liberation organization in the Bronx as a symbol of male chauvinism and re-socialized by the women who assigned me to, you know, to do childcare, to do layout and design for a newspaper and go to men's meetings. But when I got married, you know, my wife is a feminist and our first child was a daughter. So I decided one of the benefits of feminism was teaching my daughter everything that I had been taught about sports as a male child growing up in Brooklyn. So I had her throwing and hitting balls by the time she was three, but also giving her lessons in mental toughness, like, you know, some of which my wife didn't entirely approve of, like if you fall down, don't cry unless you're bleeding. And if somebody pushes you, knock them down. And when you walk on an athletic field, strut. So by the time she was 5 years old, my daughter could throw a ball 20 feet further than my wife and could swing and miss at any moving object without ever, you know, swinging and missing. So at five, she, you know, I enrolled her in the local Little League, where she became this sort of instant sort of sensation. And then I used, you know, kind of the experience to sex integrate Brooklyn sports. And the most dramatic one was when she was 10 years old. She was starting off guard on a boys' Catholic youth organization team, which won the Brooklyn CYO championship. And then when she was 11, all the coaches got together to ban girls from boys' basketball. And they announced this at the first day of the season. Well, when I heard that, I called friends of mine who were reporters of the Times and Newsday, who did basically front page stories about this, brought in all the TV stations, and what do you know, within one day, the CYO had rescinded its rule. And so, you know, getting in, there were, and you know, other girls soon followed into these areas. I mean, you know, Sarah wasn't the only one. There were about five or six really athletic young women in the neighborhood who were doing the same things. She was the only one with a crazy parent who would, you know, take on anybody who tried to ban these young women from activity. So it was a great experience for me. And you know, and I think she also was very proud that she was able to open up these doors, you know, through what she did.
Well, Mark, it's been a pleasure to talk about your years of engaged scholarship, as you put it, and the story that you end the white boy with. I love which you're talking about, the display case in your department, and how there are pictures of demonstrations where faculty and students are mm-hmm. are in the photographs, and next to the books of the published faculty next to, together.
Yeah, yeah.
And you say that I can think of no place in the university community where I would rather be.
That's absolutely right. I mean, I love what I do. I still feel as excited going to work as I did, you know, in 1972. And I still feel the fire in my belly. So, you know, hey, what could be better?
And thank you for sharing that fire with us.
Well, thank you very much. This was a great interview.